Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, the fact of the matter is that if you're a big fan of River Crossings, the next 2 weeks on Londonist Out Loud are for you. But do not be deterred if you happen to prefer a lively character, some quirky things to see and do, and some historical trivia. You won't be disappointed either. I'm right next to the Mayflower Pub this week on the south bank of the Thames, where many of the old timber-framed houses have been patched up and repaired using pieces of ships. In fact, glance through at least one of the shop windows there and you can see that the crossbeams towards the ceiling are held up by knees, which is to say wooden versions of what we'd call brackets. Now, they come from ships, and if you have a fracture in one of those, or if it's gotten too dry and is starting to give, then your ship is weak at the knees. It's the 11th of July 2014. I'm in Quentin Wolfe. And this is Londonist Out Loud.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door. Hey baby, step out of me. See a piece of air, land and sea. Some creep, some saw.
Well, hello, hello. We're by the Thames, and it's just rain. There's a very curious, I would say, autumnal feeling in the air, which is odd given that we're a long way from that season just yet. You'll hear the waves lapping against the shingle by the shore. We're on the south bank here. We're in Rotherhithe. Off to our left, we can see the Shard just about capture a bit of the eye. But on the opposite bank, really, what we can see are the old wharf houses, probably full of modern flats now. And there's a sort of a lazy Sunday afternoon feeling to the place, despite the fact that we're midweek. So that's a place of contradiction so far. It's the first time I've been to Rotherhithe. I'm here by recommendation of a listener, in fact, Raoul Summers, who pointed us in the direction of the Brunel Museum. So I'm here with the director of that museum, the curator thereof, also Robert Hulse. Hi.
Hello. Welcome to the eighth wonder of the world.
Thank you. Brunel is one of those names that I feel should have a greater significance in London. I'm aware of bridges that have come and gone that were created by him. And in fact, next week we're going to be at the bridge exhibition over at the Museum of London Docklands, and we'll be talking about all of London's bridges. But of course, there's also tunnels that Brunel is famous for. So really, I suppose the place to start might be to just get an idea of the overall impact of this one individual on London.
Yes, he's our most famous engineer. And although people think of him as a Bristol man, there's more Brunel in London than in Bristol. And he always lived in London. And he only went to Bristol because he was half drowned just 20 paces from where we're standing.
Given that we've got the museum behind us and the Thames in front of us, did he nearly drown behind or in front?
He wasn't swimming. The museum is a converted engine house. It's a scheduled ancient monument, and this is where Isambard King de Brunel, our most famous engineer, began his extraordinary meteoric career at the age of 19 years, working with his dad, a Frenchman.
Oh, right, yes, this is one of those facts that's sitting somewhere in the back of my mind. And there was another Brunel who was involved in similar sorts of things. I guess whenever one thinks of Brunel, it's difficult to escape from that iconic image with the chains in the background, the enormous chains. And he's there puffing out his belly and smoking a cigar, enormous sideburns, big top hat.
That's right, little man, big hat, big ideas, big chains, big cigar. And that photograph was taken just down the river on the Isle of Dogs. So it's a London photograph. And those chains were used to launch his last project. We're standing right by his first project, 19 years old, working with his dad. But his last project was down the river on the Isle of Dogs. And that was the biggest ship in the world. It's called the Great Eastern. It was nicknamed Leviathan. And it was a ship so big they had to launch it sideways. The Thames is not wide enough. It was big enough to steam from here to Australia and back again without refueling. It was the biggest ship in the world for 50 years. I mean, we're looking at the Shard, and it's the tallest building in Europe for the moment, for another few weeks, but there's always another one coming up behind. They're building a taller building than that in Russia. But the Great Eastern was the biggest ship in the world for 50 years. The next ship to go past it in tonnage was the Lusitania. So it really was a Leviathan. It really was a sea monster. The other nickname which Brunel didn't favour was the ship that doesn't like the water, because they struggle to get it down the ramps. The obvious way to launch a ship is, it's called a free launch. It's on top of the slipway. You remove the chocks. The ship slides gracefully stern first into the water. The lady with the big hat smashes the bottle against the prow, and there we are. It's like in all the films. But this was so big that Brunel thought a free launch would be too dangerous. So it was pushed inch by inch down these ramps by hydraulic rams. So it was the ship that they couldn't launch. They invited thousands of people to see the launch and they couldn't get it in the water. It's a terrible humiliation. And that photograph that you've just described, which is the iconic engineer, which is of course the figure who now represents the Industrial Revolution ever since the opening ceremony of the Olympics, where Sir Kenneth Branagh portrayed Brunel. That figure, triumphant as you've just described him, is the figure that soon after collapsed and was taken to his London home and his sick bed and deathbed, as turned out. So it's a wonderful irony that the picture which exemplifies the engineer triumphant actually is undercut by this rather sad story, because he died just soon after and 53 years old. That was his last project. Where we are now, this is his first.
Before we move on to more positive stuff, what did he die of? What killed him?
Well, he smoked 40 cigars a day, which is not a good idea, and he learned to swim in the River Thames, which is...
During the Industrial Revolution.
During the Industrial Revolution. I mean, I wouldn't recommend people learning to swim in the Thames now. It's a lot cleaner. But certainly in the 1820s, that's not a good idea. And he survived on 4 hours sleep a day. Well, a night, I suppose. He survived on 4 hours sleep. So he burnt himself out. But they reckon that it was Bright's disease, which is a kidney disease, that actually dispatched him.
Was he fond of a tipple as well? Looks as though he may have been.
Well, he's half French. Sorry, that's a terrible thing to say. Yes, I think he probably was. Yes, there is no record. I have no reason to doubt he didn't enjoy a good glass of fine wine.
Something about his girth seems to suggest that. Well, let's whiz back in time then. Now, you say 19 years old. Let's see if I can remember any dates at all. I'm gonna have a pot shot at this. I'm gonna say that would be about 1828.
Close. Yeah, he began working here 1825 as a 19. In fact, he took charge here. He his father was taken ill. His father, the Frenchman, had a stroke, and he took over. He was resident engineer.
Now, when you say here, what was here that he was taking over?
Yes, we're standing, and I know it's autumnal, but this is Rotherhithe Beach, just behind you. You could take your bucket and your spade. You see, there's a strand there. And actually, you'd find something out that Brunel found out just here, because we're standing directly above the first tunnel under a river anywhere in the world. This is an international landmark site, and it's very important for engineers because it's the first tunnel under a river anywhere, and it's a tunnel through soft earth. Now, paradoxically, the easiest stuff to dig through is rock, solid rock. Soft earth is very difficult because it caves in. And if you were on that beach behind you with a bucket and a spade and you dug any depth at all, then you'd find out, as children find out all over the world, the hole caves in. The hole caves in because it's sand, it's soft earth, and also it fills with water. So if that happens to children on the beach just down there, then it's happening even more so here, building a tunnel. And the answer is you build your hole above the ground.
For the listener to whom that made no sense whatsoever, I'm with you. How, what do you mean you do? You build your hole? No, I've no idea. So you construct like a tube or something and drop that down?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. What you do is, the engineers call it a caisson. But what Brunel did here was he built a tower 50 feet tall. Now, remember, Marc Brunel is French. His son Isambard is half French. They come here with fanfare explaining they're going to build a tunnel under the River Thames, and they start building a tower 50 feet tall. So they were barracked, of course, they would be now. And it was along the lines, you're going the wrong way. Along the lines, call yourselves engineers. In this country, I don't know what it's like in France, but over here, all our tunnels, absolutely all our tunnels, are underneath the ground. Look at the instructions. But the trick is that the shaft, the tower, the 50-foot tall tower, was built on an iron ring. So it's like a pastry cutter. It is like the biggest pastry cutter in the world. It is a 1,000-ton pastry cutter, or caisson. And they dig from the inside, and as they dig from the inside, the whole thing sinks down like a pastry cutter into a soft dough. And what began as a tower 50 feet tall finishes up as a brick-lined shaft. So, yes, they built the hole above the ground and sunk it. And they're the first people to do that. And that's what people do all the time, all over the world, ever since.
Now, I've got a bit of an imagination crisis going on here, because what I started out with when you described the 50-foot tower was something vertical dropping down vertically, but clearly the tunnel ends up being something a bit more like horizontal. How does it shift from one to the other?
That's the second stage. Yes, they sink the tower, and then they lower into the tower the miner's cage. And this is Marc Brunel, the Frenchman's patented invention, which is used now in automated form in cities all over the world. It's a tunnelling shield. It's a tunnel boring machine. It's the world's first tunnel boring machine. And what they lowered into this sunken hole was a contraption, a huge big contraption with 36 cages for 36 miners. So each cage is the size of a man, and each man has in front of him a wall of planks. And each man takes out the top two poles that hold the top plank in position, and then removes the plank, and then digs to 4 inches, about the size of a brick, then puts back the plank, puts back the poles, extends them 4 inches, braces them against the cage, and takes out the one below. Digs to 4 inches, replaces the plank, extends the poles, takes out the ones. It's incredibly laborious. And when the miner has done the whole of the wall in front of him, and the man above him and below him have done the same, then those three in a row are pushed forwards by screw jacks. Like the thing you'd use to change the wheel of the car, but much bigger, of course, and pushing sideways instead of upwards. And as the screw jacks push the cages forwards, then bricklayers working behind them build the walls. And that's the only way you can dig through soft earth. Inside a small cage, so it doesn't cave in on you. Digging in narrow strips, so the exposure to danger is limited. And moving gingerly forwards, and as you move forwards, building the walls behind you.
Stunning to imagine that. Can you imagine the time-lapse photography of an operation like that?
Yeah, it's a huge machine. It's consuming hundreds of men. Because you've got 36 men at the front, and behind them you've got people moving out the spoil, and behind them you've got people bringing up bricks and cement, and above them you've got people working the pumping engines, because
bringing in oxygen. And
well, no, sadly, no oxygen. There wasn't much air down there, and if you could get some, you should breathe it. Because someone else will have it if you don't. And they worked in the most appalling conditions. I've described it as best I can, and it seems quite neat and quite organised. But the planks that kept back the soft earth didn't keep back the water. So the men in the cages were showered with Thames water from the start to the finish of the day. And that wouldn't be pleasant today, but in 1825, the Thames is the biggest open sewer in the world, so they're being doused with sewage all day long, and they're not just dodging sewage, they're dodging flames because they're digging through what was marsh. I mean, here we're standing on the esplanade over Rotherhithe Beach, but of course the configuration was much more complex in Brunel's day. The river was twice as wide. The border between land and river was convoluted and intricate, and this neat wall just wasn't how it was. This is marshy, and where you get marsh and rotting vegetation, you get marsh gas or methane. So these men, they have oil lamps. Quite unreasonable to ask them to work in the dark. But of course the oil lamps ignite the methane, so there are flames as well as sewage shooting from the cages. It's appalling. I mean, it is the worst job in the world. But they only work 2-hour shifts. They collapse after 2 hours, and they're carried out and replaced by men who are still breathing. And they work until they stop breathing, and they're replaced in their turn. And in this way, looking now across the river, it's about 1,200 feet. In this way, Brunel's miners inched their way underneath the River Thames.
I find that astonishing to think of. I don't know whether this is... I'm almost certain this is bringing a sort of a modern mindset to something 200 years old. But whether... Was there any kind of ethical dimension to treating a workforce in that way, or subjecting a workforce to those kind of perils?
No, there wasn't. Life was cheap, and there was a strike. They wanted more pay, and young Brunel's answer was to sack everybody and get cheaper people in. So it is a very different kind of social context, and they did work in ways that we would not dream of working now. And only 6 men died in floods, but there is no record of the numbers who died from cholera, typhoid, dysentery and the rest, because they're showering in sewage. You know, it's dripping down their faces, it's going in their eyes, they're ingesting it. It's just too unpleasant to think about for too long. And even those who didn't die, and they did die when they left the workplace, so you couldn't actually pin it on the Brunels. I'm perhaps being a little harsh, but I'm describing not the way Brunel worked, but the way all work sites were in the early 19th century. Those who didn't die suffered. They had, they called it tunnel sickness, and the symptoms were skin complaints, of course, respiratory failure, blindness, temporary or permanent, madness, temporary or permanent. If the brain doesn't get oxygen, then it doesn't work, of course. And a nice touch, this, I think, rotting fingernails. So it's unpleasant, but they're paid quite well. They were paid £1 a week, which doesn't mean much to us. But if I tell you that a police inspector got less than £1 a week, then it's a good wage. They're not big, strong, stupid men. They are big, strong, brave and clever, technically accomplished people. Do you know there are clever people designing buildings, but there are also clever people putting them up? Mm. And you know that. I'm hopeless doing jobs at home. I stand in awe at people who can fix things, and these are people who could fix things.
These are people who could put up a set of shelves.
Yes, they surely could.
Well, we've focused quite a lot on the people down the tunnels here. I suppose one thing that comes to mind is that it's quite a specialist thing to be getting into, the digging of enormous tunnels, the creating of enormous ships. He seemed to have vision. Part of what you were saying about his father and inheriting the business from his father almost makes me think that personal talent and wits aside, it's almost as though that was one person split between two generations that happened to be able to run the same business and focus on the same operations. Is there anything in that? Was he off to an advantage because his father was doing what he was doing?
Yes, I think he was. And the other father and son team were the Stevensons, George and Robert Stevenson. And Robert Stevenson was Isambard, King of Brunel's great friend as well as rival. So yes, it was quite difficult to look at what Isambard King de Brunel did and what his father Marc Brunel did. And a lot of engineers say it's impossible to divide them. Some engineers say that Marc Brunel, the Frenchman, was the father, was the greater genius. And of course his son was prolific. Tunnels, bridges, steamships, steam locomotives. He was a polymath. But his father, this may surprise you, if you're looking for the father of the modern world, it's not Isambard, it's Marc Brunel. Because Marc Brunel, the Frenchman, is the first person in the world to devise a system of automated production for the pulley blocks on the sailing ships. So they're the things that you use to bring up the sails and take them down again. And that canvas is really heavy. And in a wind like today, it's even heavier. And if it's wet, then it's putting a terrible strain on these pulley blocks. And these pulley blocks are made by hand, or they were. The Admiralty had 150 skilled craftsmen making pulley blocks round the year for the ships in the Navy.
I'm imagining the pulley block would be sort of a wheel in a kind of a triangular shape that's pinned to the deck or something like that.
Yes, that sort of thing. Yes, like you see on those films, and a wheel that goes round and you pull the rope through that. That groove and bring it up. And what Marc Brunel did was he divided the process of manufacture. That's a modern word, isn't it? He divided the way you make these into six separate stages. And he built a machine to perform each of those stages, and a self-correcting machine, so it could be operated by unskilled people. So with Marc Brunel's invention, they were producing more blocks and better blocks and more cheaply with 30 unskilled labourers instead of 150 skilled craftsmen. So that's the, I've just described as best I can, the world's first automated production system.
And there's the seeds of the Industrial Revolution right there.
Exactly right. And also the Luddites and 150 skilled but unemployed craftsmen. That absolutely is the world that we live in. And it wasn't Henry Ford who began it. It was Mark Brunel. He did the same thing again for boots. I mean, they're called Wellington boots, but they should be called Brunel boots. And our great battle at Waterloo, where Wellington's troops were victorious, his soldiers were shod with boots manufactured in an automated process, like the one I described for the polyblocks, by a Frenchman. They were, isn't it funny to think of it, they were French boots on English shoes at the Battle of Waterloo, and they were French polyblocks in the ships at the Battle of Trafalgar. So,
I'm slightly more in awe of the idea that the Battle of Waterloo, I've got to recast it in my mind that everybody on the English side of the Battle of Waterloo was dressed in Wellingtons.
Yes, well, they're called Wellingtons because they come up a bit. They were army boots, and no, they weren't green wellies.
Please let me have that idea.
Well, okay, now you hold on to that. But the story is that Mark Brunel saw soldiers coming back from the Peninsular Wars, and they were limping. And they were limping because they had badly made boots. And worse than that, I don't know how you choose a good boot, but one of the things you might do is pick it up. And if it feels heavy, then that's well made and that's substantial and that's solid, and I'll wear that. But unscrupulous cobblers were putting slabs of clay in the heels of boots to make them feel heavier and better made. And of course, if the clay gets wet, then it's soft and it distorts. And then when it dries again, it hardens into some appalling shape that is not friend to heel or ankle. And so these men were marching in badly made boots by, I don't wish to cast aspersions on all cobblers, but some of them were unscrupulous. So that's why Mark Brunel, the Frenchman, thought he'd do the same thing again. He devised an automated production system for the manufacture of boots. So some say he's the greater genius. Certainly he's the father of the modern world. But I would, seeking a middle path, I'd always say that actually when you look at the accomplishments of Brunel, you have to look at the father and the son. And a lot of Isambard Kingdom Brunel's triumphs drew on his father's experience and know-how. His father did a lot of the drawings for Clifton Suspension Bridge, his most famous bridge. And the ship that was launched just down the river here, the first modern ocean liner, despite the SS Great Britain in Bristol, which is a triumph of conservation and good fortune that it wasn't destroyed, you know, as you probably know, it was towed from the South Atlantic and has been restored and won lots and lots of awards. But if you talk to a marine engineer, they'll tell you that the Great Eastern launched just down the river and the Thames was more important for three reasons. It has a double hull for the first time. It has bulwarks or walls from the keel right up to the top deck. And uninterrupted walls, unlike the Titanic. And for the first time in marine construction, you have, and this is his debt to his father, you have construction on an industrial scale. So this massive ship, which is 700 feet long, that's that's like a felled skyscraper. That's like a 50-story skyscraper. That's what it is, stretched out on the other side of the river.
We're not short of 50-story skyscrapers that we can look around at right now. That's an impressive thought.
Yeah, well, 700 feet. Yes, when they look at ships, often they do line them up against skyscrapers. I don't know how tall the Shard is that we're looking at now, but it's a good long ship. It's longer than Paddington Station, which is his railway terminus in London. Here's a man building ships longer than railway terminus, and it was the first example of marine construction on an industrial scale. So this is massive 700 foot long ocean liner, and they hammered 3 million rivets into this thing, each plate, and there were 30,000 plates. Each plate has 100 rivets on it. There are 30,000 plates, but there are only 3 different sizes. So this is standardized production. So this is absolutely what his father was doing in those examples I've given you. So you can't say, well, that's IKB and that's Marc Brunel. The truth is, if your dad was doing your job, you'd ask him, or your mum for that matter, you'd ask them how to do it, and that's what Brunel did. And I have to say, there was a third Brunel. Just over there, you can see Tower Bridge. Now, that's a Brunel crossing.
Is it really?
Yeah. The man who designed it, the man who won the competition for the design of Tower Bridge, was called Horace Jones. But within a year of winning the competition, he was knighted and dead. And
what a year that was.
Yes. Yeah, light and shade, I suppose. Light and shade. within a year, he was dead, and the bridge was built by his two engineers. And his two engineers were Henry Marc Brunel and Sir John Wolfe Barry. Henry Marc Brunel is the son of Isambard Kingdom Brunel, the grandson of Sir Marc Brunel. So there's a dynasty, 3 generations of engineers in the Brunel family. It's funny, isn't it, that Tower Bridge, one of the most famous bridges in the world, and it's built by Henry Marc Brunel, son of Isambard Kingdom Brunel, and Sir John Wolfe Barry, son of Sir Charles Barry, who built the Houses of Parliament. So 2 children of 2 famous parents, they build one of the most famous bridges in the world. Nobody's heard of them. If you see the slightest leanings towards celebrity in either parent, just get rid of them, because they will only get in the way. 3 generations.
So that's it from the end of part one. Robert Hulse is advocating patricide if you suspect your parent may overshadow you. That's official. I can see now why it's called the Brunel Museum rather than the Isambard Kingdom Brunel Museum. We're going to be back in just a moment. We're going to take a word from our sponsor.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm in Quentin Wolfe. We are at the Brunel Museum in Rotherhithe, and I've just come into a brick-built shed, I'm going to call it. It's not much more glamorous than that. There are wooden beams supporting the roof. There are 2 or 3 gantried levels here. It's all very industrial, and lots of red tile on the floor of various ages by the looks of it. The far end I can see leads off into a sort of cobbled, perhaps a courtyard or a passageway. I'm not sure what's through there. And the walls are lined with pictures, busts, maps, and other things. We're in Rotherhithe, of course, and somebody scurrying past was just introduced to me as Lottie the Midnight Apothecary and Cocktail Gardener. I don't know if that's real. She was flesh and bone. She was a real person. But what is she doing here?
Well, this is an industrial building. It's and it is as utilitarian and as unglamorous as you describe. And it was built to house pumping engines to get the water out of the tunnel. And I'm looking now, you see through the door, at the cocktail garden.
Let's have a closer look at that. I'm just going to take you across to the doorway, listener. Everything outside the museum is sky blue, by the way. The outside is all coated sky blue, and there are sky blue wrought iron railings surrounding an area that's floral. It looks like wildflowers in there. What happens in there?
This is the hottest pop-up cocktail bar in town. And in Brunel's day, of course, this was the top of the shaft, the sinking tower, the hole that was built above the ground. So this would have been covered with steam engines and pumping engines and boilers, and it would have been very, very noisy. Now it's an oasis of calm, and it is what Lottie, the cocktail gardener, calls a potager garden. So that's the French word for soup, potage, and a potager garden because there are things to eat there as well as things to look at and enjoy. So, of course, there are herbs, and I'm looking at lavender and rosemary, and there are also hollyhocks, which I don't think you should eat. There's rhubarb, there are runner beans later, there are rose hips later, there are trailing strawberries and runner beans, and this is a vine. This is Chateau Brunel on its way. And because this is an Anglo-French project, just further along the railings, there are hops. So this is a pretty little garden full of things to eat and things to enjoy and look at. And it's also where every Saturday through the summer we serve the best cocktails in Europe.
He says, thereby breaking trading standards rules flagrantly. I have a little bit of a concern because I'm imagining, if I've understood you correctly, this is on top of a 50-foot shaft, and I'm imagining Lottie, the cocktail gardener, digging in some potatoes or something and tumbling to her doom.
Well, it hasn't happened yet. Do you want to go up and see it?
No, not at all, if that's the possibility.
This way.
No, thank you. Oh, dear, we're going. I've got to say, this is an avenue down which I didn't think we'd be turning.
A monkey puzzle which was made by the local children. There's a monkey puzzle tree in the garden below, which was seeded from trees that Brunel planted. So here we are.
And this is quite safe, is it? Are you sure there's not 50 feet of emptiness below us?
It is safe, and there is 50 feet of emptiness below us. But we've had this tested, and the engineers say you could put a Humvee on top of this and it still wouldn't sink. So it's solid, it's robust.
What a curious choice of expression the engineers have.
Yes, I know. Well, they're sort of very attaboy, aren't they?
They choose not to deal with actual weight, you know, kilograms and so forth.
I think they were simplifying it for me, but they chose the wrong paradigm.
What would you have chosen as an example of a heavy object?
Well, bus, I think, would have been closer to it for me.
A Londoner through and through.
Yes, my familiarity with Humvees is slender, yes.
And I think that may be line of the week. So we're in a little clearing here. We've got some benches around what looks like might become a barbecue at some point.
Yeah, this is a sundial. And it's got stovepipe hats ringing it. And on cocktail evenings, we do make a little fire here and we toast marshmallows. And there's a list behind you of the cocktails on offer. Gin, rose petal syrup, jasmine infused, elderflower liqueur, lemon juice, orange bitter and soda. Strawberry thyme, which is vodka, thyme-soaked strawberries, lemon juice and soda and maple syrup. Chocolate mint julep.
Oh, I'm getting hungry.
I know. It's good, isn't it? You should come.
There's a wonderful effect here. After it's rained, you can have the flowers giving up their perfume a little more readily. And we're standing next to a bed of the most glorious blooms in tangerine and russet and scarlet here. And the smell is wonderful. There's also bushes of what looks like lavender. Beautifully fragrant. Not the sort of industrial landscape I was expecting to encounter today.
Exactly. And isn't it wonderful that this is so very different from the kind of fierce, noisy, headache-producing racket that must have been going on here in Brunel's day. This is a little calm sanctuary. And it's a very popular cocktail bar.
Remind us again what days you have events here.
The cocktails every Saturday evening from 5 o'clock till 10 o'clock, and this Saturday we're celebrating Bastille Day because Marc Brunel was French. So we have music as well as cocktails, and cocktails with a French twist. Twist français. I don't know what the French for twist is, but I mean...
not sure I'd understand you if you did.
Well,
a bit of Cattle Juillet action. it's quite interesting when you look up, there's the correspondence here of the chimney coming from the museum itself, and over the back of it there's a church spire, and those two things really seem to combine to tell you what the foci were of early Victorian days, I suppose.
The chimney is for the... for the pumping engines that were getting water out of the tunnel. And the spire, that's St. Mary Church, Rotherhithe, on the occasion of the first flood, because this tunnel flooded five times, on the occasion of the first flood, the vicar at the time, which is May 1827, the vicar took as his text the day after the disaster. He took as his text just judgment on the presumptions of mortal men. The only sad thing for the vicar, I think, was
he knighted and then died immediately.
Well, nobody died to add substance, and yeah, nobody died in the first flood. The vicar, happy, long and particular life, I think. But you shouldn't take texts after disasters about why they deserved it, I think, is a general rule.
Yes, I strongly agree. We need to head below stairs, I think, because I've heard that there's something worth looking at down below.
Yes, let's do that.
Should we go? Yeah, okay. I just want to really flag up, I guess, as I started the podcast, I mentioned the sense of calm. I really do mean that. It's very few places, I think, in London, particularly in the middle of the week, in the middle of the city, that you can find a sense of calm, and this really does have it. Just to locate where we are, Rotherhithe is on that newer spur of the Overground, the one that goes from Highbury and Islington and connects around, I think it goes via New Cross and connects up with Clapham Junction. It's dead easy to get to, and the place is literally by the station. You can't miss it. I really think popping in here is well worth a look. I think my guest may agree with that.
Yes, I quite impartially, I think you put it beautifully well. Yeah.
Well, yeah, where are we off to now? We're not going through the main part of the building itself. Instead, we're heading past several brilliant benches designed to look like bridges.
Brunel bridges, yes. This is Hungerford, which is Brunel's first Thames bridge. And the piers are still there. They carry the railway bridge into Charing Cross.
Now, what was that? Because that bridge lasted for a very, very short period of time, didn't it, before it was removed. Why was that?
Yes. Well, there's nothing wrong with the bridge. I mean, it was actually a very good investment. It was built in 1841 for £80,000. And it was sold to the railway in 1864. So, 20-something years later, was sold for £120,000. And whilst it operated as a pedestrian bridge. It was a suspension bridge to take people over the river to Hungerford Market, which is now the site of Charing Cross Station. they charged a penny toll. That was the fee for crossing the river, by the way, by boat, by bridge, by whatever. And the revenue from pedestrians crossing was £25,000 a year. So that's actually, you know, capital growth and substantial revenue. There's another figure I don't have, which was the money that the Thames River steamers paid to use the piers, which are still there, use the piers to embark and disembark.
Hold on then. This has just completely transformed my understanding of what Brunel was up to. Engineering triumphs notwithstanding, he was actually sort of an arch capitalist, wasn't he? He's building money-making objects, whether it's a tunnel, whether it's a bridge. These things are creating revenue.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think he has a reputation, and it's a bit undeserved, of being a bit of a financial disaster. But this is a very good investment. And these were all business propositions. Some of them went wrong. The Great Eastern we were talking about, it was never the huge financial triumph that they expected. But it was a ship that was commercially active for 25 years. That's a good record then. It's a good record now. This tunnel, it is still being used 100 and something years later. In Brunel's day, it didn't do very well financially.
And it was intended as to be used by people on foot and horses and carriages, was it?
Well, mostly for cargo. I mean, it was used by people on foot. In fact, it opened in 1843, and on the first day there were 50,000 visitors. So, I mean, that's fabulous. In the first 3 months, this is 1843, in the first 3 months there were 1 million visitors. That's half the population of London. So, yes, he's a businessman. I think he's probably a better businessman than his father. But he made some bad choices, of course, but not all of them. I mean, that was a successful bridge. And here it is. It's capped with campanile towers, so like something you see in Florence. It was a very elegant bridge that Brunel built. The towers have been taken down. The chains that we're looking at, the chains now span the gorge at Clifton and his Bristol Bridge, so they were reused. Over here, this is one of the arches of Maidenhead Bridge.
What are you pointing at?
Well,
oh, that bench.
That bench, yes, under that false acacia tree with the bolts through it. It's our Frankenstein tree. there's an arch, which there are two arches at Maidenhead up the river, of course, and that was and is the longest, flattest, widest brick arch structure in the world. And it's still there, taking trains on the Great Western Railway. And here is...
We're looking at a bench now with a slightly... I'm not going to attempt to do bridge shapes. That's beyond my pay grade, I'm afraid, but there's a train going through this one.
Yes, and it's actually a suspension bridge. You can see the chains. But on top of the suspension chains, there's a tubular arch. And that's the cleverness of the design, because you see on Hungerford Suspension Bridge, there's a chain going across the two towers, but on each side of the towers there are anchoring cables, because if they weren't there, the towers would just collapse inwards. So the anchoring cables are stopping it from going in on itself. And on an arch bridge, and you see one underneath the tree there, the forces are pushing outwards. So if the abutments and the foundations at the end of the arches are not properly done, then that will explode. Mm-hmm. It will collapse, push outwards.
Yes, a tap with a hammer at the centre of the bridge would be disastrous.
That sort of thing, yes. Yeah. But here you have the arch, the tubular arch, pushing outwards like it does on that at Maidenhead, and you've got below that suspension chains pulling together. So they're in opposition and they're equal. It's in balance. It's a very clever piece of engineering. The maths is complicated. It's beyond me. These are Brunel bridges. That's the one between Devon and Cornwall. And that's his last bridge. And these won awards. They were designed by our resident artist and built by local children on our play scheme.
Were they really?
Yeah.
They're worthy of awards themselves.
Yeah, and the little steam locomotive, that was done by children working with the blacksmith who has a... We have a blacksmith. He has a mobile forge. And on the...
Yeah. Well, the thing I'm enjoying most about this podcast is you keep just offhandedly introducing me to these this range of unlikely characters. The cocktail gardener, the blacksmith who just happens to pop in.
Yes, it's getting a bit Great Expectations, isn't it? And then the shaven-headed man in the marshes, Magwitch. No, that's not true.
Well, you say that, but a shaven-headed man just walked past to whom you waved.
Yes, he's not a convict. Dave is a good chap. Yeah.
We should move away from that controversial territory. I'm saying this only because we have a show full of bridges next week. I think we should do some tunnelling.
Yes, let's do some tunnelling. So it is my great pleasure to invite you into an extraordinary dramatic space that has been opened up for the first time in 150 years. And it's where Brunel began. So follow me. There are some wooden steps, so up the wooden step.
Now this is the tradesman's entrance to the Lay Eye.
Put your left hand on the handrail,
yep,
and your right foot on the first footplate. And you see there's another footplate in the wall.
Got it, yep.
And then to here, and then spin, and then one, two, three, duck.
Sound of presenter tumbling. The door that I'm approaching, listener, is about waist height at the top.
Follow me.
This is very John Malkovich. Oh. I don't think I can get in. Hang on a second.
Yeah, you're a bit big for your way, aren't you? It's a very short tunnel. It is low, but it's very short. And
just because you're missing the visual here, listener, the move I've had to make to get through the little passageway into this area is like the famous Cossack dancing.
And to your credit, without the music to help you through,
we're entering the top of a scaffold, and below us I can see some chairs ranged out, but I'm not far enough down the gantry ladders to be able to see what we've got. Oh, look at this. Now I can. We're entering a big cylindrical space. I'd say about 15-20 feet still to go before we hit the ground. And multicoloured lights are illuminating the walls of this chamber.
This is the Grand Entrance Hall to the Eighth Wonder of the World. And it is, as you describe it, and it was very different in Brunel's day. The big step there. This is where Isambard, King of Brunel, nearly drowned. And he was sent from here to Bristol to convalesce. You hear the train? The train is beneath our feet.
So that's the overground line that I was talking about that goes through there now. It used to be the East London line.
That's exactly right, yeah. And on this big canvas here... Oh, here's another train.
Well, you wouldn't know... From the sound, you wouldn't know you weren't on the platform.
No, that's right. And they're every 3 minutes. It's a very successful piece of urban railway, very fabulous addition to London's transport system. And this is how it used to look. Do you see here this big canvas?
Yeah, okay. The thing that I'd noticed on the wall here, you can see an indentation that's going up more or less diagonally, and you can pretty much guess that that's where a staircase would have been. And looking at the canvas here, a very elegant and elaborate staircase. If you think about the entry hall going into some sort of grand family house in the deep south pre-Civil War, then you'd step in and you'd see the landing high up above you, and then two staircases left and right sweeping down. But on the ground floor, instead of the entry hall, we've got the opening to two tunnels, and they stretch in on this canvas as far as the eye can see. We've got a cart and pair coming out on one side. Some people nervously attempting to cross the road in front of it just there.
This is the first tunnel under a river anywhere in the world. And on that picture you've been describing, there are two silhouetted figures in the middle. And that's roughly the level at which we are now standing, because the tunnel beneath us was full of horse and cart. It's now full of trains. And we are only able to get down here thanks to this concrete slab, which was installed when the line was closed to extend it north and south. We're very grateful to Balfour Beatty Carillion and Transport for London for installing this concrete floor. There's a water pattern. This is a reference to the five floods that happened in this chamber. One of them took the lives of six men, and the lights around it, they are theatrical because this is a theatre space and we have concerts and performances down here, and we're now directly below the sundial in the Pottinger garden where we were stood just a little while ago.
Oh, that's my fears assuaged. Okay. You're not going to plummet to the centre of the earth, then. You're merely going to interrupt a theatre performance.
Exactly, that's right, yes.
Well, I'm just taken with the correspondences in the picture here. And that really is a great... There's something about the Victorian eye when it comes to... whether it's the great sewers or whatever it might be, some of the... power stations, there is a sense of grandiosity, isn't there, and confidence.
Yes, the tunnel was designed to move cargo by horse and by cart, and this picture that we're looking at, as they say, this never happened. This is what was going to happen. They were going to use the tunnel to move cargo under the busiest river in the world. We stood and looked at it a while ago, and there was very little movement, the odd Thames Clipper going up and down. And we do heritage boat tours three times a week. But in Brunel's day, this was the busiest river in the world. In Brunel's day, there were 3,000 tall masted ships in the river every day, a forest of ship's masts. There were 10,000 little boats. The river was the biggest traffic jam in the world because the trade of the world came up and down River Thames. The British school children of Brunel's day were living in a world where a quarter of the land surface was the British Empire, and British school children were taught the sun never sets on the British Empire. The Spanish school children were taught the same, of course, but it was a French friend who explained to me the sun never sets on the British Empire because God doesn't trust the British in the dark. Perhaps he's right not to. And the tunnel was designed to move cargo under the busiest river and in the biggest city and the most prosperous industrial nation in the world. This was the workshop of the world. This was the industrial powerhouse. Jeremy Clarkson did that wonderful saying. Do you remember when he championed Brunel for Greatest Britons? He said, Brunel built Britain and Britain built the world, so Brunel built the world. Now, Jeremy is as grandiose as Brunel, frankly. So he's a wonderful champion for him. And Brunel came second behind Winston Churchill in our Greatest Britain's competition.
Well, you touch on a terrifically important point, though, that, to my mind, when we think about these construction projects, for example, being able to bridge the Thames, tunnel under the Thames, the very manufacturing processes, in fact, that you were talking about with the looms and industrial processes created by Isambard Kingdom Brunel's father, this was a city where lots of stuff was being made and woven and put together. Now, you know, we sit looking at computer screens. We're a service industry city by and large. All the shipping's gone. It's a very different vibe, but the purpose that the city, small c, serves is entirely transformed.
Well, that's right. And the reason the tunnel was finished is because of that old perspective, because of what you just said. The tunnel... And we talked about how this tunnel was built inch by painful inch under the River Thames. What I didn't tell you is that it took 18 years to finish. So men grew old and died building this tunnel. This is the sunken hole. This is the tower built above and sunk. 18 years to get 1,200 feet across the other side. And it was only finished because the government absolutely understood the importance of a symbol and the importance of an international perspective of Great Britain being great and being an industrial warehouse. And not, I mean, for all kinds of reasons, you can't have a half-completed tunnel at the centre of this big, populous, successful trading and industrial nation. The tunnel was finished because of national pride. It was finished because you couldn't continue to sell Britain as the workshop of the world if right in the centre of it there's a half-completed white elephant. Is that a mixed metaphor?
Well, at the risk of stepping on corporate toes, I've got to pick my words carefully, but I believe that I remember when the Eurotunnel, as the Eurotunnel project evolved and got off the drawing board and started to be dug, I think it's reasonable to say that there were financial challenges faced by those who were going about that project, and I seem to remember that extra rope was given to them than might otherwise have happened in order to try and get that to completion. And again, I think that was a face exercise, wasn't it? A face-saving exercise. You say tunnel. I see tunnels, two tunnels in parallel.
Yes, but it was built as one big tunnel. It was one big rectangular tunnel, and they split it in two.
Ah, I see. Okay, so the actual tunnel is rectangular, and then we've got two arched tunnels within. Ah, that makes a lot of sense.
This is still one of the largest bores in the world.
Well, that's very good of you to say so. I do try.
Yes. I think I say that with a smile because that's exactly what my daughters say of the man looking after this tunnel.
Unbelievably, we're up against the end of our allotted time on this week's show, and I can tell not only from the fact that I'm still hungry for a lot more, but also from the expression on the face of my guest this week that there are one or two more things to say. So I sort of think we're compelled to try and squeeze them in to our last couple of minutes. I might ask, what are the things that people should know about the Brunels, perhaps I should put it that way, that they don't, and what should they know about the tunnels and about the museum that they don't?
I think people should understand that the Brunels were fabulous improvisers. I mean, this tunnel, which was designed to move cargo under the busiest river in the world, opened as an underwater banquet hall, an underwater shopping arcade, an underwater fairground, an underwater multicultural festival, and an underwater knocking shop. Until it was sold to the railway in 1865, and there have been trains running through it ever since. So this is, we were talking about Brunel as a businessman, and not all of his business enterprises were successful, but goodness, when things didn't go quite according to plan, he was ready with another idea and another PR stunt to push it along the track. And I like to think that at the museum, we're doing the same kind of thing. It's a very small museum, it's a very big story, and we're very excited about the possibilities of this space. And you are amongst the first to enter this underground chamber. For 150 years, it's been completely inaccessible. It wasn't until this floor went in that we could bring people down here. And we do have concerts down here, and we have opera down here. We had Mozart down here. 100 people enjoyed Così Fan Tutti. We have world music most Wednesday evenings. We have cocktails above ground every Saturday through the summer. And I think it's in the spirit of that kind of manic, improvisatory flair that Brunel had. We had some MPs come here. No, parliamentarians, I should say. Parliamentarians came here. And the parliamentarians were the guests of APGUS. It's an acronym, and it's the All Parliamentary Group for Underground Spaces. And they are the lobbying arm of the tunnelling industry. And I asked the chairwoman of APGUS, what is the message for the parliamentarians, if there is one? She said, yes, there is a message. And the message is, build it properly, because you don't know what it will be used for. And that's kind of counterintuitive, because this, because it was properly built, is now an underground theatre space, and above an overground cocktail party, and below the oldest tunnel in the oldest underground system in the world. This is improvisation in spades.
On which tantalising note and highly appropriate usage, we have to bring things to a close for this week. We focused heavily on the tunnels side of things and on the figure of Isambard Kingdom Brunel. As I mentioned, next week we're going to be at the Museum of London Docklands there to visit an exhibition focusing on London's bridges. You can expect IKB's name to pop up there again as well, I suspect. And we have only time to mention the website of the Brunel Museum here in Rotherhithe.
www.brunel-museum.org.uk.
Well, Robert Hull, thanks very much.
Thank you.
My heart aches for some far off place, no one could have left you with your name.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Robert Hull. Thanks to Mark Barr and Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.